We actually get into the panel discussions and the questions that I'm sure you all have, I'd like to just briefly summarize the session today and also tie it in with the work of the Signal Generator Subcommittee. Basically, the papers presented have dealt with the various advances made in recent years on two basic types of signal generators. In one case, a frequency synthesizer employing direct digital techniques, and in the other case, a phase-locked, or I better qualify this, or frequency-locked, high-frequency signal generator. It's been pointed out that these new developments have been made possible by advances in component technology. It has also been shown that these instruments have been developed in response to existing or potential applications that require more stringent or special performance characteristics that have been available previously. Finally, Ray Shannon went through the test methods which had to be developed specifically to meet some of these advances that they came up with on these particular generators. As a result of these advances and more stringent specifications, this has led to a requirement for better standards that have existed up to now for signal generators. As Ray pointed out, the specs leave a lot to be desired. So this sort of ties in with the work of the IEEE subcommittee that I'm involved in. This subcommittee was formed to help the user, in addition to providing guidance to the manufacturer of signal generators. At present, the user is faced with the problem of selecting a suitable unit for his particular application from a wide variety of instruments which are currently available on the market today. They vary considerably in price and performance characteristics. The specs generally available for these instruments are often complex, and they refer to undefined terms in many cases, or in some cases, inadequately defined terms. In many cases, they're vague and incomplete. For example, I'm sure many of you have seen specs which state typical performance over a range, frequency range or power range, to describe a given performance characteristic. In other cases, accuracies are given without stating certain reference conditions. In addition, specs are often based on a particular test method chosen by the manufacturer to verify a given performance characteristic. This leads to various inconsistencies, which I'm sure you all have seen, between manufacturers in specifying basically similar instruments. Because of these factors, standards have been developed to assist users of test equipment in specifying and selecting an instrument that meets their particular need and as a means of making intercomparisons of available equipment on the market. Now, I'd like to get into the work of our IEEE subcommittee. Actually, the subcommittee is part of the parent committee, which is called the IEEE High Frequency Instrumentation and Measurements Technical Committee, and this is part of the IEEE Instrumentation and Measurements Professional Group. And these committees have sponsored the preparation of various standards covering components and also electrical electronic test equipment. The current chairman of the parent committee is Dr. Gunther Sorger from Singer, who's supposed to be chairman today and is absent. I might mention that these standards require approval by the IEEE Standards Committee, and in addition, The standards are coordinated with the IEC, that's the International Electrotechnical Commission, which is also involved in developing similar standards. I'm a chairman of the Signal Generator Subcommittee. We're responsible for an updating an existing standard on which is called Proposed Recommended Guide for Specification of Signal Sources. This is AIEEE standard number 451 of April 1955. I guess you can all realize how obsolete this is. And it also contains insufficient detail to cover or adequately cover the modern-day signal generator. Our particular subcommittee became active about a year ago and includes members from both test equipment manufacturers and also users of signal generators. The current members include representatives of the Army, Navy, and Air Force metrology groups, and also a representative from the National Bureau of Standards at Boulder, Colorado, in addition to various instrument manufacturers. Just to cover briefly what we intend to include in this standard, it will consist of three sections. The first section will contain definitions of terms and parameters usually associated with signal generators and which are used in subsequent sections of the document. The second contains a tabulation of the various performance characteristics which would normally be specified for given types of signal generators. We also indicate whether these performance requirements should be included or are optional characteristics. In the third section, which we actively engage in right now, is to come up with recommended test methods for verifying the various performance characteristics. This provides just a brief description of the work of the subcommittee. And if there's any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them later on. I'd like to turn the meeting over now to two questions and also a panel discussion. But I want to just point out that the order of these questions, it'd be desirable to first cover the papers, address our questions first of all to papers presented today, and then get into any further questions regarding the IEEE subcommittee work. And finally, I'm sure questions have arisen as to further need for new hardware to satisfy particular needs for new types of signal generators and other general questions relating to applications. And I'd like to cover that last. So I think we're ready to go ahead now with our questions. I might start off. I'd like to address this question to Ray Shannon. In the measurement of attenuation to minus 145 dB, where you utilized a spectrum analyzer and used a digital voltmeter readout. Yes. Now, what is the repeatability of that readout indication? Is it fairly stable, or what is the resolution? Can you read to a tenth of a dB, or do you have to average out readings?
No. The stability of that system is pretty good, except at the very, very bottom band. On the bottom, the lowest signal noise ratio we get to is around 15 dB. And at that point, I suppose there is a several tenths of a dB change in the value, and we do essentially average it. On the higher values, it's very good. Can everybody hear me? If you can't hear me,
I'm sorry. I'll try talking. At any rate, as I said, that the signal noise ratio is about 15 dB on the bottom levels. And at that point, there is a couple tenths of a dB fluctuation in the voltage, and we do average it. On the higher values, it's a very steady reading. As far as repeatability, I'm not sure. I think the accuracy that we really depend upon there is something like three tenths of a dB overall, and I'm sure it's well within that. It's not as precise an attenuation measurement as you normally expect in a calibration lab to 0.5 dB or something like that. We don't attempt that in a production type setup.
Is it necessary to conduct these tests in a screen room?
No, it's not. It's just necessary not to get on any. Well, as a matter of fact, the system is all enclosed. It's all shielded because we use coaxial cable and what have you, and. Spurious is not a problem. It's a very narrow band receiver, fixed frequency, 3 megahertz, very low dispersion. So all you have to do is stay off of a spurious signal. It's made a routinely on a production line. One of the problems I didn't really talk about there, and that's the isolation that you've got to achieve between that 3 megahertz phase lock loop and your 3 megahertz output loop. You have to be careful about getting a sufficient isolation there. We actually have a fixed test setup where we've modified one of our tracking generators. There's lots of room inside of it with the mixers and using semi-rigid cable to get isolation. But it's a very practical system. You can set it up on a bench anywhere and do it with reasonable accuracy.
Okay, thank you. Can I have the next question?
Well, I will address this question either to Mr. Sandstrom or Mr. Cannon. This question of frequency lock, phase lock. Now, for years I've been under the impression that when you talk of a system with frequency lock, you generally have a certain amount of frequency incoherence in the system. When you talk of phase lock, you have frequency coherent but phase incoherent. And if you have to go one further and to get phase coherence, you have to have one additional loop to correct the phase.
You have to have one additional integration.
Right. In the systems that I've seen presented here, the one system in the Hewlett-Packard device appears to be a sort of a phase lock, but not quite. I don't, strictly from memory, it did not appear that you would have total frequency coherence. You will have some, let's say, phrasing it, some cycle-to-cycle error in frequency.
There is no such thing, in my estimation, as total phase coherence.
No, not phase, frequency.
I'm sorry, frequency coherence from that standpoint, because all systems have incidental modulation at some level. Now, the question is how low is that level? And the only frequency incoherence that we have is a result of the residual FM, which we do not correct in the new 760 box from Logimetrics. They use a wider bandwidth, and they do get better correlation. But it's still there. It's just a question of level, and it really has nothing to do with the characteristics of whether it's phase-locked or not. There are lots of other parameters, the difference between a phase-locked system, the characteristics of it. And basically, when you boil down all down to the simple facts or mathematics, it's simply the sign on the 1 over S term that the coefficient in the derivation of the transfer equation. In our system, it does turn out that it is a 1 over S term because the integrator and we have an integrator that follows the phase detector. So it is actually a 1 over S squared term. And, we correct that if you were to take a series of measurements at sufficient time and average them, there would be no frequency error result and no phase error result as well. Now, short-term wise, there is residual FM, and admittedly, it's more than what you would normally expect in a so-called phase-locked system where the phase lock loop is used to correct the residual FM. We don't do that, as I explained. The thing that we were after there was long-term stability of the carrier so you can test crystal control receivers and maintain full FM capability. The problem if you don't do that is if you have a wide bandwidth to reduce residual FM, you have difficulty in FM modulating. It turns out if you modulate up through the loop and it turns out to be phase modulation, you got to do correction on that. And you have all these other problems. And it was not our purpose to use the characteristic of a phase lock loop to reduce residual FM.
Why didn't you say this yesterday? Actually, in our case, we have both ways. As we considered our 925, which is a called signal lock, there it is a frequency lock, and it averages the frequency over a period of time effectively. And my definition of frequency lock and phase lock is that when you go into lock, if the residual FM remains the same, it's a frequency lock. And if the residual FM decreases by a large order of magnitude, then it is a true phase locked unit.
The importance really is the end characteristic of the user. That's what we find.
Right.
freedom.
Are we talking about the cycle-to-cycle variation in frequency or a long term of variation?
Well,
10-20 cycles or cycle-to-cycle?
Actually, I think in a phase lock, it's cycle-to-cycle.
Yes.
And in a frequency lock, it is the average frequency that is compared to a reference. The average frequency over a period of time. Like in our case, we sample it over a period of 10 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds.
Why not bring up a rating in the rating of the generator as to similar to a pulse generator, stability of the pulse, phase jitter of the pulse?
Well, we do this. We do this.
We do this.
Single cycle of frequency, a phase jitter on that one cycle, some rating, something like that, instead of phase locking, consecutive centitude, something that we would understand.
Well, I think the number that you're looking for, the characteristic, is actually the residual FM. That's really, and not on a cycle by cycle basis. I'm not sure I know. Certainly, I don't know how to measure it.
In a practical application, we have no need for phase jitter. In a practical signal generator application, we have no need for that.
You have a need.
Anything we're testing is receivers or transmitters, which we have no application for. And most of the generators are way beyond. Our application needs much better than what we need.
I disagree there. Some of the newer tests that are required on receivers require extremely low residual FM. There are certain tests that they call like a hum and noise test, where they have like an FM system where all of a sudden they turn off the modulation and they look at what the stability effectively of the receiver is. There you have to have extremely low residual FM if you want to get a reasonable measurement. And the state-of-the-art of receivers has forced us signal generator manufacturers to make better and better signal generators. This is continuing to go on. And again, the only spec that really, or there's two specs really that are affected when you go talk about either frequency lock or phase lock. One is the stability over a long period of time, and then the other, the most important one I think, is the residual FM. And there were two different numbers between locked and unlocked.
Yes. Further, how we understand the definition of this thing. I didn't really hear it covered today in so many words. What happens if you take the oscillator and divide it down by some kind of a divider directly, and then do what the IC boys call a phase lock arrangement where you compare a deep flip lock or some such nature to compare edges of this thing as it comes through? Phase lock and curve standard, let's say 1 kilohertz influence or whatever the influence of the power. Now, what kind of a loop do you call that? Because it is that kind of integrating out the phase noise and all the lot of the divider change. Let's still tend to call it phase lock.
That's a direct divide by end phase lock loop. That is used more in synthesizers than in signal generators as such.
That is what our system is. It's divide by end, strictly.
Okay, so you're not. You agree then that that's not really a phase lock on a cycle by cycle basis?
Oh, I don't agree with that. I think it's a sampled phase lock loop system. And I guess.
It's sampled if it's integrated out and divided by n, or averaged out
and divided by n.
It seems to me that phase noise gets averaged out when you divide by n.
Phase noise gets divided down directly by the division ratio. But, it really. And it turns out that's not. That's not even really true, because the magnitude, if you look any place in that divider chain, the phase noise is changing as you go down the divider chain, down to some reference. Down here at this reference, we force the phase to be the same within the error of the loop. I mean, all phase lock loops have two things. They have the phase jitter, cycle by cycle, on a variable oscillator, and they have the phase jitter on a crystal oscillator, which is normally much, much lower. And all the phase lock loop does is look at the difference, the DC voltage, which is produced by the difference in this phase, apply it in a feedback system in such a way that error voltage is reduced by the loop gain, whatever the loop gain is, and only for frequencies within the loop bandwidth. That's all. And that's what a phase lock loop does. So I would have to disagree with you. Yeah, there are tons of divide by end synthesizers on the market. I'm sure that they claim to be phase locked, and they have all the characteristics of phase locked. They do. Now, the problem is that it's a sampled system. And any, as we all know, any sampled system, you're limited as far as trying to put modulation or put information through it to one over half of the sampling rate. In our case, to get the 1 kilohertz resolution at 550 megahertz, our sampling rate happens to be 50 hertz. So our loop bandwidth then is necessarily restricted to something lower than that. It turns out to be about 5 hertz.
It seems to me that the thing comes a lot clearer if you think about the actual kind of numbers that you have. For example, it's not unusual at all to say have 1 hertz FM peak to peak in a 10 million cycle wave.
Yes.
So when we talk about is it on a cycle to cycle basis or not, this means in the phase system, it will never slip even 1 cycle.
It'll never slip.
Even if you wait forever.
But
even the FM, in the sort of bad case, is only going to slip 1 cycle after 10 billion cycles. So when you talk about, are we doing it on a cycle by, of course you are. In both cases, you're so damn good that the difference is almost indistinguishable. The real difference will be that in the phase case, you'll never slip a full cycle.
That's right.
No matter how long you wait. In the other case, you will gradually pick up this very, very small amount of FM. So that really, when we talk about it, there's a great big difference there. It's really very
well. It's well said. There is not that much difference. As a matter of fact, as far as the user is concerned, it doesn't make any difference which system is used. What you're really interested in, as you point out, is what is the residual FM?
That's what I was getting at. As far as the end users.
You're correct.
We never see this at all. Don't you think that's adding unnecessary expense to the construction and the design of the generator to include this phase lock loop?
In our case, we offer it both ways. And
stability is beautiful without this.
Well, our problem is in trying to design general purpose equipment, it may be perfectly adequate for what you want to do. And but we have lots of users that it's not adequate. And really what this says is if you
do
come
you
in,
really have lots of users that it's not accurate? I mean, where are you going? Up to 500 megacycles with a generator like that. Isn't most of the application up around 150 megacycles? Most of our applications aren't most of them in the VHF region?
No.
You got mobile rate?
Mobile?
You have applications around 460 or so in the mobile bands around 430.
330 megacycles.
Do you need that 1 cycle stability up in that frequency range?
For many measurements, you do. For many measurements and receivers, you do. You have to have.
You might be talking about space receivers that have a 10 cycle bandwidth or something. But communication receivers, what do we have? 3-5 cycle bandwidth, KC bandwidth. We never get down into the 1 cycle, 2 cycle.
There is a measurement that you do for all two-way communication things, and that's like a hum and noise test where you have a certain amount of modulation on and turn the modulation off to look at the stability effectively of your receiver. And there you have to have actually phase coherence. Or otherwise you're reading. Normally you have to go down 45 dB or 50 dB depending on the system. And there you need the low residual FM.
The other point that I'd like to make is, you mentioned, doesn't it add a lot of additional cost? And my answer to that would be no, it does not add additional cost. It's much additional cost once you've already put the circuitry in to do the counting. Once you've done that, it's a very small incremental cost to go ahead and provide the lock feature. That's really it comes almost for nothing, and there are applications for it, and if you're designing for general purpose, the highest quality that you can get in a box, it's true that some of the features may be more than what you require, but I really think that the differential cost is small.
I agree there. Once the counter is there. That's three quarters of the, or even more than that.
You quadrant.
That's almost the entire cost of the thing.
I have another question related to the counter at this time. You go through all the trouble to install the counter and the frequency deviation and the modulation meter, and there's no way we can use that externally. There's no external input to this thing. If we're checking a transceiver on the bench, we have this beautiful signal generator setting there, and it's all included. It's right there, but we can't use it.
You can. We do have external count capability to 550. It is available to you.
I see on a block diagram you have an external input, but that looks like a time base.
No, I'm sorry. We have both. We have external time base. We have external input on the counter.
Okay.
550 megahertz.
There's no way of getting into the deviation meter or the modulation meter.
You can. Yes, it's the meter is used for. You're wanting to measure AM and FM deviation. The circuitry, the meter there actually does not measure AM and FM deviation. Most of the signal generators today don't do it. All of the systems are open loop calibrated systems where the AM terminal, the leveling loop, and the FM terminal are calibrated in so much percent modulation or deviation per volt. And then what we do is add a little audio voltmeter in there, accurate to a megahertz or whatever, to read that applied voltage. And that's what we do. And we say, our experience is that we set them up such that you put a volt here, you get so much. We don't actually make a measurement.
It's not actually a discriminator in the circuitry that we can get into somewhere.
No.
Make
no. It's an audio voltmeter, and it is available in the front to you in the front, but it's not what you want to do.
I don't think there's any signal generator available as such. There are some special purpose communication test sets that are basically have modulation meters built in.
So that's what I'm getting at. We have to use this beautiful signal generator there, and we have to break out a little chintzy test set to measure deviation.
Wait till next year.
We'd like to see it included in the generator.
Wait till next year.
I'd like to ask Rockland, what do you consider presently the upper limit in your technique for frequency synthesis, upper frequency limit, using standard parts that are available?
As I said in the talk, the limit is solely due to the D2A converter. Where right now we're using TTL logic. If we wanted to speed up the logic, we could go to ECL. That's not stopping us, it's the D2A. The present unit that we are producing goes to 2 megahertz. And this is a rather low frequency synthesizer limit. But until someone does come up with a better D2A converter, this is what we're stuck with. We've talked about translation techniques and multiplying techniques, but the multiplying technique involves a degrading of our phase noise specification to a usually unacceptable level. And the translation techniques, we're investigating them right now. But in the near future, we're not planning to announce a unit that goes above 2 megahertz. That's why I asked if anyone had an ideal D2A converter. We'd be very interested to talk to him about it. Incidentally, I have a little sales gimmick here. I have some data sheets for our synthesizers available, if anyone cares to take one.
IEEE has some sales gimmicks, too. These are available. The preprints are available downstairs at $2.50 a piece.
These are free.
Question for Mr. Shannon. You made a comment on the calibration of the attenuator that you did a little fudging at the level meter itself. The operator that he had to pick it up a little bit when you apparently went from one section to the other. Is this because of a repeatability and an insertion loss in the second section or something of that nature? You could
do that? A repeatability?
Well, I got the impression that you were trying to cancel out some of the errors in the attenuator by varying the actual meter level a little bit.
Yeah, you know, you can only make pads so accurate. And, you know, a tenth of a dB for 10 dB would be 6/10 of a dB there. So you have a potential 6/10 of a dB error in that. We consider that sufficient enough that if we were to actually get anywhere close to that spec, that we could correct for it. And admittedly, it's a small correction.
So it's if the capability is in the unit, then it has to be set up for the individual attenuator that's put in the unit.
I'm saying that we've provided a capability to take out any individual attenuator. Yes.
Now, when you do this, does this mean that this is essentially the needle moves?
The needle moves.
That's the burner.
Yeah, well, you can consider doing it a different way. You can consider actually making an AGC loop correction. But then what you'll do is actually change the percent AM. That'll throw an additional error factor into the AM percent modulation. And we didn't want to do it. It's not really, well, one of the other things I failed to mention there, talking about that attenuator accuracy, is use of the step attenuator is not a neat, as good an attenuator as the waveguide beyond cutoff was as far as accuracy is concerned. The other factors are the leveling and all this sort of stuff. You know, if you add all those numbers up, it appears to be a fairly large number. Those, I think, are fairly typical, throughout the industry. I think in some cases they're reasonably typical of what you might have really expected in signal generators altogether. And at any one frequency, in any one vernier setting, it's possible to turn the instrument up to where you have minus 20 dBm full scale, calibrate it very accurately there. I'm sorry, minus 7 dBm full scale. Calibrate it very accurately there with a power meter, and it takes out the flatness error, the metering error, the attenuator error, or the vernier error, and all that sort of stuff. Then the only thing you're left with is the attenuator error from below that point. And that, I feel quite confident saying, is less than 1 dB.
Over the range
of the attenuator, from that point, yes. Because we routinely make sure that it is, yes.
How does that error vary with loading?
How does what?
The error of the attenuator vary with loading. Must it be terminated at exactly 50 ohms and unreactive?
Well, the way you would approach that is mismatch error.
Yes.
And it depends on the visuar of the instrument, which is less than 1.3, and given that 1.3 against any visuar you put on it, you've got to take that into account.
Yes.
And we can't, we don't know. We can't guarantee. Well, you can. You just take that to those two numbers. And,
but if you terminate an exactly 50 ohms resistor, accuracy is as stated.
That's what we specify, yes. Because what we do, you see, we say that that's what it is, and we take into account that mismatch error. We know the mismatch error in our system. And we take that into account. We add that error in. It's already in there. And if you duplicate the system, you'll get the same number with the, that same error. If you have any other load, then of course you can calculate the mismatch.
Seems that the two of the companies, HP Micro Metrics, just introduced something new in signal generators, something new in synthesized sources. What do you see as the trend in this field?
Well, I see there actually is two diverging or two separate markets for this. The actually they're converging. I see that the requirements of the receiver people are requiring almost, their requirements are almost approaching that of a synthesizer. And other general purpose things are requiring synthesizers also for programmability and things of this nature. And it appears that these two separate groups, so to speak, are really converging.
We intend to be responsive to the user's needs. As soon as your people will tell us, we'll be happy to go that direction.
I think the question could be reversed. Assume we have users out here. What is it that's needed? This is their interpretation of what's needed, these signal generators. Is this the correct interpretation? I think the question's out there.
It's you people out in the field that are requiring us, effectively, to be competitive and to design instruments that meet your needs.
We should have some better channels of communication between the user and the manufacturer that we could fill out a card and circle some numbers and get back to you some way. Because we have some practical applications that we'd like to talk to you fellows about. We just got to get around to it.
That was another thing that was pointed out in that roundtable discussion group, and that's the fact that a smaller company, you can get on the horn and talk right to the engineer. And of course, Hewlett-Packard, in spite of its bulk size, it still attempts to be a small company atmosphere down at the level where we are. And of course, it's one of the opportunities we have here at this show. I'll be on booth duty. Ralph will be on booth duty. Will you?
No.
Well, at any rate, And really what we're doing is trying to attempt to report to you, like at this meeting today, and say, okay, here's what we've done, the reasons we've done it, try to give you some of the thoughts that went into the engineering, some of the problems, and try to make you aware of some of the different operating characteristics of the instrument so you become more knowledgeable and that you can make better choices between them, and also to talk to you. And we're very much interested in knowing your applications, and believe me, we'll respond once we know the need.
Also, I think that this subcommittee that we have on signal generators is will produce a document explaining the definitions of what all the terminology, what it really means, and how these measurements are made to justify the specs that all of us equipment manufacturers state.
One of the things we universally agreed on was the fact that we need users' representation on that panel. You know, if we could get people knowledgeable in the end use of the generators to step in and also tell us how and what they want defined and all this sort of stuff, you know, that would be what they want to see on the spec sheets and how they want it. You know, I have, you know, reams of data on the 8640. And I just can't publish it because every time we publish a typical curve or typical data, you know, every customer from that day on starts saying, well, I want a typical instrument or better. You know, if I ship you one that's, you know, one sigma high on our distribution, I don't want it, you know. So there's lots of information like that that we'd like to make available, and we really find it difficult. We try to do it in like these papers, articles, journal articles. So if you're so inclined, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but...
I agree.
Well, we really need some standards. It's been lacking for a long time. There's much confusion out in the service industry.
Well, I think speaking for the military, there's a tendency to buy more than actually needed for many applications. Of course, they don't give enough study to the end application.
Also, what we're trying to do is that have all the equipment manufacturers state the specs in the same terminology so you can compare apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. Because in the past it's been one company would spec it a certain way with certain numbers and somebody else would spec it differently, and it's sometimes, many times, it's very difficult to compare the two.
Yes. That's what this IEEE
right.
standard should avoid now.
We're attempting to.
I'm going to ask you a question about that wideband unit that you just announced. What is the residual on that at the low frequency? Or you lose the percentage?
You mean on the unlocked unit, the regular unit?
The unit that you're now going to develop all your frequencies by being two high frequency oscillators.
All right, there
the
dividing there. All right, there the residual FM basically remains constant across the entire band. There's a small change. Very small change across the whole band, but it's basically, that's why it is spec'd a little bit differently. Normally, residual FM is spec'd in just plain parts per million, but here we have it in parts per million plus a certain fixed number of hertz. And it basically stays basically the same across.
I mean, is it good enough? Because that's, you know,
it depends on what your needs are. Well, we have a quarter part per million plus 50 hertz.
50 hertz is a minimum.
Right. Actually, typical number is around 20 to 30 hertz.
Excuse me, can I interrupt just a second? I think we've exceeded the lot of time. I know many of you have additional questions. I would suggest that we at least end the formal part of this meeting. And for those of you who have any further questions, feel free to stick around and speak to us. So I'd like to just wind this up by thanking all the speakers and panel members and the program organizer, Dick Hall. And thanks a lot for your active interest in the papers.
Hey, Phil, how come you didn't have any comments?
So you're an old pro.
What's that?
Hey, thank you for coming. You're on for session.
How do these respond to their required pulses? And if the
Mr. Jacob Huchberg?
The reason I'm asking is that the phase transistor.